This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega, and thanks for joining us. According to new data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, overall gun-related deaths in the United States are on the rise. Mass shootings are the most visible kind of gun violence, like those of the past few weeks in Pennsylvania, Florida, and California. But gun deaths overall, including suicide, show no signs of slowing down. Last month, the American College of Physicians released new guidelines around gun safety, calling for research into gun violence and urging doctors to communicate gun risks with their patients, kind of like what doctors do when it comes to asking their patients about smoking.
We ask our patients if they smoke. And if they say yes, then we start the process of talking to them about counseling and their desire to quit.
That's Dr. Sue Bornstein. She's the chair of the American College of Physicians Health and Public Policy Committee. And she's also one of the co-authors of the new report from the American College of Physicians.
We don't believe that asking about whether there are firearms in the home is really any different from that. But if they do have firearms in the home, then it's when we get into the more detailed questioning about, do you have children? Do you have adolescents? Do you have persons with dementia or serious mental illness?
But in response to the latest recommendations by doctors, the NRA tweeted this, quote, "Someone should tell self-important anti-gun doctors to stay in your lane." And that rubbed a lot of doctors very much the wrong way.
I think it really touched a nerve, the message from the NRA for us to, quote, stay in our lane.
The NRA says the new report is based on bad science and that its authors don't respect gun ownership. But Dr. Bornstein says that's not the case.
We understand the Second Amendment. We accept that the Second Amendment is law, and that is not under consideration here. But what we really are asking for is common sense approaches to reducing the trauma, the injuries, and deaths that are associated with this epidemic. As physicians, we have a unique opportunity to potentially prevent or reduce gun violence if we see risk factors in our patients. And so knowing what those risk factors are, identifying them, and then asking our patients questions about whether they in fact have any of these risk factors.
In reaction to the NRA's comments, doctors across the country have come forward in protest, taking to social media to share their stories of the trauma of gun violence and their own struggles to save victims' lives. Many are using the hashtag #ThisIsMyLane. Some reached out to The Takeaway.
Moments you always remember. Medics furiously doing CPR on an 8-year-old. Small hole just above left eye. Best friend was showing off his dad's pistol. No hope. Such a small body. Such a small hole. He died. You have no idea what we see when we close our eyes. This is my lane.
And like so many physicians, Dr. Bornstein's position on gun violence has been born out of bearing witness to that trauma.
My patient is a 15-year-old young man who was very depressed and suicidal and had access to a handgun and one day put the handgun under his chin, shot himself, and in the process lost his tongue, his jaws. He was not able to speak. He was not able to swallow. Those people stick in your mind for a long, long time.
We as physicians and other healthcare professionals, we're the ones that take care of victims every day, right?
Dr. Megan Ranney is an emergency physician and the chief research officer for the American Foundation for Firearm Injury Reduction in Medicine, or AFIRM. She's one of a flood of doctors who came forward to say gun violence is squarely in our lane.
We're the ones that tell parents that we've been unable to save their loved ones, and we're the ones that take care of the aftermath, the physical and psychological trauma that survivors have to live with.
Dr. Ranney has treated hundreds of gun violence victims in her career and says doctors are key to solving the gun violence crisis, just as they've been for so many other public health issues.
I think gun violence has traditionally been approached as a criminal justice issue when what it really is a public health issue. Shootings are an epidemic in the United States right now. The number of shootings is going up year after year, and it's just a kind of injury, just like any other. We've stopped epidemics before. We as physicians and other healthcare professionals know how to solve epidemics. And we can do the same for gun violence if we just approach it using the public health tools that we have.
And how do we go about that? Because we think about, I think about other public health issues like smoking, for example. We've seen a decline in the number of smokers in the United States. There have been campaigns for years. How do you do that with something as political and as contested as guns in America?
I think the biggest thing that we need to do is to make this not a political or a contested issue. And one of the things that I'm proud of is when you look at Affirm Research, the organization that I serve as chief research officer for, we're a collection of physicians, researchers, and healthcare professionals from every specialty and across the various healthcare professions. When you look at our advisory board and even my co-founder, many of them are gun owners. This does not have to be an us versus them issue. Most gun owners are actually very safe and follow safety precautions and know basic things like that it's important to keep a gun away from someone who's suicidal, right? So I think part of this is taking the discussion out of the political sphere and putting it back in the hands of public health experts, just as we've done for smoking or, heck, for safe sex, right? When you talk to your doctor about sex or drinking, we do it in a way that is nonpartisan and hopefully non-accusatory. I think we can do the same here.
Have you treated gun violence victims in the ER?
Oh, gosh, yes. It is part of, sadly, the bread and butter of emergency physicians' training and daily practice across this country. But the worst part, of course, are the people that have never made it to us. A large percentage of gun violence victims die before they even make it to our doors. And part of our mission is to create hope for those folks, right? To create hope that it doesn't have to be this way, that we're not losing people before they get to us, and that we don't have to do as many resuscitations in the ER and the OR. We want to create a better way where we prevent these gunshots from happening.
I'm wondering when this became an issue for you. Was there a moment in your career as a physician that made the turning point for you, or was there a patient whose story really stands out that made you want to focus on this issue?
So there are two things. One was early in my career, as an attending. So after I'd finished my residency, I was in my trauma rooms, and there was a call for a code blue young male gunshot wound. And my trauma team prepared like we always do, and we thought we knew what would be coming. And what actually rolled in was a young man who had shot himself in the head. And it turned out that he'd actually used a family member's gun. And that moment stuck with me because I had never before and have never since seen a suicide attempt with a gun, because guns are different and are more likely to kill. And then the second thing, of course, was Sandy Hook. I will never forget watching those pictures come across my newsfeed, the pictures of the little kids, right, being marched out of that school to be reunited with their parents. And then the parents who never were able to be reunited with their kids. I'm friends with some of the physicians that were at the hospital that day and did their best to save the kids that made it there. And that was really the moment when I said that I can't be silent on this issue. I and many of my colleagues have expertise, and we know how to solve epidemics like this, and it's time for us to come together and do that. We founded Affirm Research a year ago after the Las Vegas shooting, because it was very apparent that there was not going to be action on the part of Congress or legislators. This is something that we can do ourselves. It doesn't have to be this way. We don't have to let 200 people be injured and 100 people be killed across the United States every single day. We can use science to reduce the death toll and to stop shooters before they shoot.
Is the medical community, from your point of view, united in this approach, if you will, or in feeling that they do have something, they do play a role in this epidemic of gun violence, or at least in preventing it?
Absolutely. And an important point there is that many physicians and many healthcare professionals are gun owners. So going back to what I said earlier, that this isn't an us versus them issue, within medicine, it really isn't. We know that we're the ones who take care of the victims. And one of the things that I'm so proud of is that we really have brought together both sides and made this a nonpartisan issue. Collectively, we represent the will of medicine to tackle this epidemic the same way that we fixed car crashes or decreased deaths from HIV. We know what it takes, and we really have the will to do it.
Dr. Megan Ranney is an emergency physician, chief research officer for the American Foundation for Firearm Injury Reduction in Medicine. Doctor, thank you for sharing your time with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All right, everyone. So this idea that doctors should talk to patients about gun violence risks and treat gun violence like a public health issue, well, we wanted to know if that's something that you've ever experienced at the doctor's office and if you think those conversations belong there.
Hey, this is Tim from Vandalia, Illinois. Sadly, I've never had any conversation with any physician about gun safety or anything like that.
I was asked by my doctor if I had guns at home, if they were secure, if I was afraid or in fear of gun violence, and whether I was safe at home. Janice Plord, Nantucket.
Hi, my name is Amy. I'm calling from Minneapolis, Minnesota. No, my doctor did not discuss guns with me. She barely had time to talk about my physical needs. I think doctors absolutely should be having this conversation.
Rika, Grants Pass, Oregon. I would consider a conversation about gun violence in my doctor's office to be inappropriate in our city, which has very few gun deaths or injuries.
And we also got this from a doctor who shared her perspective.
Asked a six-year-old today what he would do if he found a gun while playing at a friend's house. He said he'd grab it and play with it. His mom was shocked. I wasn't. It was the most important thing I talked about at his well visit. This is my lane.
Thanks for weighing in. You can keep the conversation going at 877-8-MY-TATE. The implications of last week's election extend far beyond what happens over the next 2 years in Washington. Criminal justice reform was on the ballot in at least a dozen states, alongside a resurgent focus on races for reform-minded district attorneys. Nicole Lewis has been covering all of this for the Marshall Project, and she joins me now. Welcome, Nicole.
Good to be with you.
So we talked about restoring voting rights in Florida for felons, but what were some of the other big criminal justice initiatives that we didn't talk about?
Sure. So in Louisiana, voters decided to eliminate a practice of using non-unanimous jury convictions for felonies. So that means now, like many other states, 12 out of 12 have to agree in order to be convicted. There were a series of marijuana initiatives on the ballot. So Michigan voted to legalize recreational marijuana. Missouri voted to allow medical marijuana. Some other initiatives, you know, didn't pass. North Dakota decided not to legalize. There's also in Washington, they've upped the standard for police use of force. And so in the state, so prior to this ballot initiative in the state of Washington, police had to show malice or quote unquote evil intent in order to be convicted or indicted for shooting someone, you know, while on duty. And so now that's changed to a two-part sort of good faith test. So they have to show that they've acted in good faith and like a reasonable police officer would do.
And what about ones that didn't pass? There's one in Ohio, I believe, right?
Yep, absolutely. So in Ohio, that's ballot issue one, ballot measure. In the state of Ohio, the sort of context for this is that they're dealing with a crisis in their prisons, right? So the population is just exploding. And so they were looking for ways to be able to reduce that population. And so issue one would have made certain issue one would have essentially decriminalized drug possession. And so reducing penalties down from a felony to a misdemeanor, but that didn't pass.
You know, in this country, we've talked a lot about everything from law and order to criminal justice reforms, right? So here in the 80s and 90s, this was a big era for being tough on crime. And we've seen the current president and former Attorney General Jeff Sessions talk about a law and order approach to law enforcement, which is also somewhat racially, you know, implicating and dog whistling, if you will. But I'm just curious, how much of these initiatives were passed with bipartisan support?
So many of them, most of them, right? And so when you look at Florida, I think Florida is a really interesting example where they, you know, voted to restore voting rights. It was 60-some-odd percent of the voting population, right? And so that cuts across both Democrats and Republicans. And I would say when we look at criminal justice reform across the country, really at the state level, even bipartisan support in the legislatures to pass sentencing reforms to really deal with the crisis of, you know, quote-unquote mass incarceration across the country.
What's motivating a lot of support for criminal justice reform on both sides of the aisle? Do we know, is it socially minded? Is it getting people out of being incarcerated? Is it fiscal? Like, what is the motivation for conservatives and liberals?
Sure. I think it's a mix of all of that, what you named. So when you take, you know, a look across the country, 2.2 million people roughly are incarcerated between prison and jail. And so there are many states that are just, there are too many people in the prisons. And so they're facing this crisis, right? And the idea that they might have to be building new prisons, which is extremely expensive. So on the one hand, you have many conservative people and liberal folks as well who say, we can't afford to do this. At the same time, you have many more people who think, well, we need to really address sentencing laws that have created the kind of racial disparities that have led not only to, you know, right, racial disparities in incarceration, but also this booming prison population. And then you have a segment of people who believe in second chances and who believe that people who have, you know, spent their time should be able to go home. They've been rehabilitated. There's just no reason to keep them languishing in prison.
How much of the focus on criminal justice reform is racial? How much of it is the with the understanding that there are communities, particularly Black and Brown communities, that have been disproportionately impacted by this system? In other words, how much of it is not just looking at the impact, but the why?
Yeah, I think that for many progressive reformers, that they have a very solid analysis and understanding that there has been a really disparate impact and that certain communities have been harmed more than others by incarceration. And so when they go back to say, what can we do to fix this? They're explicitly looking at that disparate impact and saying, we need to make sure that all communities are treated equally, that we're not causing undue harm to Black and Latino communities over white communities, and that by and large, when you address those kinds of issues, everyone benefits, right? It's not just Black and Latino people. When you change sentencing laws, it's the total criminal justice system.
So there were also six states on Tuesday who were supposed to vote on something called Marcy's Law. What is Marcy's Law and how did it do?
Sure. So Marcy's Law is essentially a victim's bill of rights. And so what this means is it, you know, lays out the protections that if you've been a victim of a crime, what the criminal justice system has to do for you. It passed in all six states. Sort of unsurprisingly, there's a huge effort. This initiative was primarily bankrolled by a man named Henry Nicholas III. He's a billionaire out of California. His sister was brutally murdered in the 1980s. And so he has been the sort of force behind this measure and poured a lot of money into that initiative across the country.
And obviously, there were a ton of district attorneys races. What would you say was different about the DA races this year from previous years?
Yeah, so across the country, there's a slate of district attorneys who were really running on campaigns to end mass incarceration. So, you know, like you said before, they're looking at the criminal justice system and saying, hey, we've got a crisis here. We've sort of made a mistake. And so in many places, they were running against a sort of tough on crime, law and order incumbent, someone who'd been in the job for many years. And so that was a huge change. And I think largely supported by George Soros, who funded a lot of these campaigns and a lot of sort of outside interests where people are finally seeing, oh, prosecutors are an important lever if we're interested in changing mass incarceration.
And so I'm wondering, in terms of where we go from here, you know, is why don't we see more or hear more about this sort of bipartisan efforts to achieve criminal justice reform?
I think what's really difficult is that most of these reforms are taking place at the state level. And so you have to kind of go state by state in order to really get a sense of what's happening. And most people are maybe more familiar with federal criminal justice reform. So that's all you're hearing. You're hearing how, oh, Congress won't act. Does the president want sentence reform? What does Jared Kushner want? And so they're inundated with this message that there's some sort of a breakdown in the system, that there isn't bipartisan support. But if you looked at each state and what they've been up to, you can see that there's many instances of the legislature coming together and Democrats and Republicans saying, this is what we need. Here's how we're going to go forward.
Nicole Lewis is a reporter with the Marshall Project. Thank you, Nicole.
Good to be with you.
Historically, the Republican Party has been associated with a tough-on-crime attitude. But conservative support was crucial in several criminal justice reform victories on the ballot last week. Bill Hammond is a former Republican member of the Texas State House of Representatives who's dedicated his life to criminal justice reform. He's now the chief strategist for the bipartisan Texas Smart on Crime Coalition. Bill, thanks for joining us on The Takeaway.
Thank you. I appreciate your having me on your show.
So is the positioning from a conservative standpoint towards criminal justice reform one that really looks at the fiscal challenges and the fiscal impact that that criminal justice is having or incarceration is having on the United States?
Certainly, that's one perspective. But I think also equally important, or perhaps more so, is what are the outcomes? We lock up people for a long time and we don't provide them with the services, the training, the education they need. And once again, when they're released, they return to a life of crime, which is just not the outcomes we want.
Bill, I want to play something that we hear quite a bit from President Trump. Take a listen.
I will restore law and order to our country. I am the law and order candidate.
But we will also be a country of law and order.
So, Bill, that's the president, obviously, on the campaign trail and beyond, has talked quite a bit about law and order. You know, he's talked about harsh penalties for criminals. He spoke about the death penalty recently after the Pittsburgh shooting. When we talk about law and order, that can sometimes be a racialized dog whistle for certain communities. How do you see the president's perspective in talking about law and order connecting really with criminal justice reform? It just seems like those two things are incongruent.
Well, I think they are. I think that we did extensive polling of Republican primary voters in Texas. In other words, the base, if you will. And they overwhelmingly support many issues in criminal justice reform that we were working for in Texas. So I think there's a disconnect there between what even the Republican primary voters think and what the president is espousing.
We also want to talk a little bit about who is incarcerated in the United States. The vast majority of people who are incarcerated, many of them are men and women of color. These are also largely poor Americans and working class Americans who are incarcerated. So does race and class factor into how you see criminal justice reform?
Well, I mean, I think poverty absolutely figures in. You have situations where people are put in jail awaiting trial. Their lives and their financial situation is being destroyed, and they simply plead guilty to get out of jail or shorten their sentence while in prison. That's wrong. It shouldn't happen. We know that when people are out on bond, they're much less likely to plead guilty and much less likely to wind up in jail as a result of the crime that they're charged with. So I think those sorts of things are very important. To me, the scales of justice are not in balance in terms of poverty, and we need to do a better job of seeing that the system is more fair to every citizen.
Is there any room for thinking about how bias plays into the criminal justice system at all in terms of reforming it, in terms of how sentencing is laid out and other issues that affect different communities differently?
Well, I mean, I think that's definitely a situation that needs to be looked into. I think at the same time, the commonality of people who are disproportionately hurt by the system is poverty rather than race. The same is true in other areas of life. And I think that, you know, it's pretty clear that the scales are not balanced as well as they should be for those who come from an impoverished background who can't afford bail or can't afford proper representation before the courts.
Bill Hammond is the chief strategist for the Texas Smart on Crime Coalition. Bill, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me on your show.
Go to OmahaSteaks.com and enter code TAKEAWAY into the search bar to get 74% off Omaha Steaks Family Gift Package, now only $49.99. Order now and you'll get 4 hand-cut age-to-tenderness top sirloin steaks, 2 savory premium pork chops, 4 chicken fried steaks, 4 Omaha Steaks burgers, 4 snappy kielbasa sausages, all beef meatballs, 4 perfectly browned potatoes au gratin, 4 made from scratch caramel apple tartlets, plus get 4 more burgers for free. Again, just go to OmahaSteaks.com, type takeaway into the search bar, and add the family gift package to your cart. Don't wait, order today.
Michelle Obama has a new memoir, and in it, she talks about everything from her early days on the campaign trail with Barack to the Trump presidency. But she also opens up about a subject most people wouldn't expect a former first lady to talk about, infertility.
I felt lost and alone, and I felt like I failed because I didn't know how common miscarriages were, because we don't talk about them. We sit in our own pain, thinking that somehow we're broken.
That's Obama from This Weekend with ABC's Robin Roberts.
The biological clock is real because egg production is limited. And I realized that as I was 34 and 35, we had to do IVF. I think it's the worst thing that we do to each other as women, not share the truth about our bodies and how they work and how they don't work.
Obama speaking openly about her miscarriage and her fertility treatment resonated with millions of American women across the country. Because if we want to talk about the truth, well, the truth is 10% of women in the United States ages 15 to 44 have difficulty getting pregnant or staying pregnant, according to the CDC. And for women of color, the numbers are even higher. Married Black women are nearly twice as likely to have infertility problems as married white women. So what's behind this fertility gap, and why aren't we talking about it more? Dr. Desiree McCarthy-Keith is a board-certified reproductive endocrinologist with Shady Grove Fertility in Georgia.
Well, we know that Black women have a higher incidence of uterine fibroids, and by the time a Black woman is 50 years old, about 80% of us will be diagnosed with fibroids. And depending on the size and location of a fibroid, that can definitely impact a woman's fertility, can increase her risk of miscarriages and pregnancy complications. So that's one factor that we have. There's also a higher incidence of obesity and overweight in the African-American community and for Black women. When you look at the statistics on obesity in our community, they are truly alarming. The most recent statistics show that about 55% of Black women are obese in this country. And if you combine that with obese and overweight, it's almost two-thirds of us. And that is just a striking number of women who are in that category. And again, overweight and obesity can increase the risk for chronic diseases and can also lower a woman's fertility and also increase her risk of pregnancy complications. When we look at studies of women who go through fertility treatments, we see that African-American women are more likely to wait longer or have longer durations of infertility before they even seek evaluation. And so by the time they come in for treatment, often they are older, which is also a factor that can lower their chance of success once they get to the fertility treatments.
So then let's talk about what's happening in the doctor's office, because this was something that came up a few years ago when I looked at this issue, that there are some cultural differences that happen among women of color. As a woman of color, I know speaking about infertility can be culturally difficult sometimes, culturally challenging. But what happens when I go to the doctor's office? Are doctors more likely or less likely to talk about women of color's infertility options?
Well, this really begins when we look at when we first started doing fertility treatments in this country 30 plus years ago. The initial campaigns for infertility awareness and treatment did not reflect women of color. The campaigns and the ads usually contained middle-class white women, and so we weren't even included in the conversation when the treatments were being promoted or presented. And so if you did not see yourself in those advertisements, you didn't feel like those treatments were for you. You didn't feel like they were targeted to you or catered to you. I've seen several articles where women going through fertility treatments comment that when they're in a fertility office, sometimes they don't see other women of color in the office. So again, they feel isolated. Or if they see pictures of success stories and babies in some of these fertility offices, they don't always see brown babies on the walls. And so they feel, again, like maybe women of color don't do these treatments, or maybe we're just not successful, and that's why we don't see ourselves reflected in these images that we see in the office.
I also recall talking to other reproductive endocrinologists and realizing that we also don't see each other reflected as reproductive endocrinologists or as reproductive specialists, right? I'm assuming the number of Black and brown reproductive endocrinologists in the United States is quite low.
Right. We are also underrepresented in that area. And, you know, it's interesting. There was a survey study that was published several years ago where physicians were actually polled and were given different scenarios of different women, a middle-class woman, a woman of different incomes, lower-income woman, a woman of color. And the physicians were asked, which of these women do you think is more likely to have infertility? And the majority of the physicians, and these were internal medicine and OBGYN and family practice physicians, majority of them chose the middle-class white woman as the one who was most likely to have infertility, even though we know that the women of color are more likely to be the ones. So it starts with how physicians and providers perceive infertility in our patients. And so that can be reflected in our referral patterns, how we counsel patients, and how quickly we would refer them. If we think that women of color are less likely to be infertile, then we may tell her to try longer before she sees a specialist. Whereas if we think that, you know, middle-class white women are more likely to have infertility, we may tell them sooner to go ahead and see a fertility specialist. Mm.
And also, let's talk a little bit about the cultural elements here, because I think that has a lot to do with this sort of over the surface. What might be some of the cultural limitations for women of color ourselves in talking about this issue? Should we, you know, be thinking about it differently? Should we be less ashamed? I mean, what was your reaction, for example, to seeing former First Lady Michelle Obama talk about her own struggles? I wonder if culturally that's opening a door for us. We've also seen Gabrielle Union, the actress, talking about these issues. So it seems like more Black and brown women are having this conversation.
Absolutely. For Michelle Obama to speak about that in her book was so refreshing and empowering for all of us when she made those statements and started promoting that last week. I received so many texts and calls from people who said, did you know that Michelle Obama did IVF? And we think it's so great and so cool that she's talking about it. And we have traditionally in our community not discussed these type of things, even though we've had infertility in our community, the same as others. We just have not discussed that, which leads to a feeling of isolation, of shame, and just loneliness for the women who are going through. And going back to the perceptions and the stereotypes of women and fertility in our country, while the campaigns for infertility focused on women who didn't look like us, we were often stereotyped to be hyperfertile, to have multiple children, to need birth control more than we would need fertility services. And so many women in the community have internalized those stereotypes so that if she does have trouble getting pregnant, she feels like, you know, Black women can have babies. It must just be me. There's something wrong with me. I feel broken. And then they become even more ashamed and more closed about their journey. So I think that when we have prominent people like Michelle Obama, Gabrielle Union, who can speak on that, it gives a face and a voice to it. And it takes some of that stigma and that shame away. And when we see women who are highly successful, accomplished, and who share that, it really just equalizes and shows us that infertility does not discriminate based on age, ethnicity, status, you know, anything. It can affect us all. And so it's really refreshing to have this conversation that's kind of brought to the forefront now.
Dr. Desiree McCarthy-Keith is a board-certified reproductive endocrinologist at Shady Grove Fertility in Atlanta. Doctor, thank you again.
Thank you so much.
I'm a Black woman with polycystic ovarian disease and all of the terrible symptoms that manifest. Difficulty in conceiving is one of them, navigating my desire to have a kid and all the roadblocks, in addition to a marriage that wasn't a safe space. To deal with this kind of issue was very hard. And we don't talk about mental health the way we need to in the Black community, unfortunately.
Are you a Black woman or a woman of color who's had difficulties with infertility? We want to hear from you. Tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE. And that's our show for today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
NYC Now delivers the most up-to-date local news from WNYC and Gothamist every morning, midday, and evening. With 3 updates a day, listeners get breaking news, top headlines, and in-depth coverage from across New York City. By sponsoring programming like NYC Now, you'll reach our community of dedicated listeners with premium messaging in an uncluttered audio experience. Visit sponsorship.wnyc.org to get in touch and find out more.